This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Is at today's rally, he brings us this report.
So we were just talking about how officers across the nation over a course of several years had organized and joined our union, SEIU, and officers here have been working for quite a long time now to, in those efforts, and now they are in negotiations with some of these larger security firms. And so officers are out here today to have their voice heard, to let folks know that our community deserves good wages, fair wages, affordable health care. And I think a major piece of this is officers looking to raise standards in the security industry across the board.
So where do you work?
I work downtown Portland here. I work six different buildings. So I go in and patrol the outside of the building and the inside, and then I do like garages and their basements. I look for leaks and people that are trespassing.
Is this a dangerous job?
It can be. I patrol graveyard shifts, so I'm walking out here at like 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, and we're not allowed to have any kind of protection with us. So,
and as a woman, it's particularly dangerous.
It is very dangerous for women to be out here. I am the only one that I know of that's a woman that patrols like I do.
So what is your what are you trying to get with your contract here? What are the issues that are most important to the guards?
Health. If I go to doctors, I pay for all my health care, from any tests to just a regular checkup. So, yeah, healthcare is really, I think, a big one amongst all our officers. And a fair wage. Because we are out here and we're taking care of multi-million dollar buildings. And we're really getting peanuts compared to what we're guarding. So, yeah, and like I said, for a woman, it's really dangerous.
And what is the starting wage for a security guard?
$10 an hour. It's really hard, especially if you have to buy medication. My husband is disabled, so he gets a pension and stuff, but over half of his money goes to paying for his medication alone. So, and that's not even counting if I have to buy a medication. So I don't even go to the doctor 99% of the time because we can't afford the medication even if I was written a prescription for one.
Thank you, Randy.
Hey, Portland.
What?
We tell the story.
What?
We tell the whole wide world.
This is Union Territory.
This is Union Territory.
This is Union Territory.
Security officers under attack. What do you do?
Stand up, fight back.
What do we want? Contract. When do we want it?
Now.
I do not think that the tenants of these office buildings are going to leave town if the security officers working there are paid a living wage. Am I right?
Yeah.
And speaking of leaving town, you know, one of the things, the reasons they give us for why we've had rising inequality over the past 30 years is it's globalization. You know, if we don't accept lower wages, they'll just outsource the work to India or Thailand or what have you.
Yeah.
But you can't outsource security officers.
Right.
And that gives us power. So we're going to use that power. And we're going to fight for a living wage. We're going to stand up. We're going to fight back. We're going to win. Get out there and win!
Those were the voices of a rally in support of Portland security officers, compiled by KBOO's Jamie Partridge. That last voice was Portland City Commissioner Steve Novick.
After facing pressure from youth advocates around the city, Portland Mayor Charlie Hales has agreed to reinstate a summer job program for at-risk youth. Hales initially decided to cut the Summer Works program as part of the across-the-board budget cuts announced when he took office in January. During his campaign for mayor last fall, Hales promised to maintain the Youth Jobs program and expand it, saying that it helps kids figure out potential career interests and provide job search training. About 3/4 of program participants are minorities, and 4 in 5 are from low-income families. Portland Commissioners Amanda Fritz and Dan Saltzman called on Mayor Charlie Hales to restore nearly $400,000 to youth programs targeted by Hales last month for budget cuts. In restoring funding for the Summer Works program, Hales now has to find somewhere else in the city budget to cut $200,000.
Portland voters are set to vote on whether to fluoridate the city's water supply this coming May. As reported earlier on the KBOO News, city commissioners met secretly with chemical industry lobbyists well before the public was made aware of plans to dump toxic waste into Portland's Bull Run water. Now, new information shows that the fluoridating industry also conducted a lengthy campaign to line up support from local activists and minority health groups. KBOO's Joe Meyer has more.
Last September, City Council voted 5-0 to add fluoridating chemicals to our Bull Run water. Local activists quickly collected over 40,000 signatures to refer the fluoridating ordinance to voters. Subsequent to that, City Council voted 3-0 to curtail public debate and move the ballot measure up a year to this May 21st. The quality and quantity of public debate on fluoridating has been a consistent issue. Here's Mitch Purcell of the Urban League.
You know, this issue first came before the City Council as a possible ordinance. And it was an ordinance that was actually passed after many months of testimony, debate, you know, kind of public engagement in this issue. I understand that it is an issue that many people have concerns about. But I think that those concerns and those issues got a very robust airing at the time, and the City Council felt that it had enough information to make a decision, which they did. However, you know, now it appears that we're going to have an additional conversation and people will have an opportunity to vote. The Urban League is involved in this because we feel that people need to have the information that they need in order to make an informed choice. You know, at the end of the day, each one of us who are registered has one vote. And we feel that, you know, we are looking forward to a really robust conversation where we are able to kind of look at the science. We are able to kind of look at the best practice in many other cities, both in the U.S. and internationally, and look at the outcomes. And, you know, kind of weigh those, you know, weigh that information before we cast our ballot.
In that regard, were you sorry to see the election moved up a year to seemingly lessen public debate?
You know, I think that there is going to be a robust public debate on this issue. And, you know, as it should be.
That was Mitch Purcell of the Urban League. And here's Kim Kamensky of Clean Water Portland, the group responsible for collecting the 40,000 signatures to refer the issue of fluoridating to voters.
I heard about it in early August of last year, and I got a call from a newspaper reporter and wondered what I knew about attempts to fluoridate Portland's drinking water. So I was pretty shocked to find out that there were plans in place and that it sounded as if a lot of work had been done behind the scenes to get everyone's ducks in a row, and this was before anyone knew what was going on.
Is there evidence that lobbyists from the industry met with a city council?
We know that they did. They hired a well-known and well-paid lobbyist to go behind the scenes to get city council. They had to get 3 out of 5 city council members to sign on, and that took place again before anyone realized what was happening. They're not able to convince 151 state legislators to mandate this for the whole state, but it's easier to convince 3 out of 5 city council members, and that's what happened.
Well, there's a large number of local supporters from minority groups.
You know, it's an interesting issue because it is definitely one that crosses party lines. It's very bipartisan. We have everyone from hardcore conservative to raging liberal, and a lot of the minority groups, too. It's interesting that you mention that because there was a poll that was done recently showing that 57% of non-white people in Portland do not favor fluoridation. So 57%. So there seems to be a disconnect between what the individuals in these communities are reflecting compared to some of the positions of the organizations that represent these communities. So I think that right now we really need to let people know what is happening. It's going to have a huge impact on our water. We're talking about the addition of industrial waste byproducts into all of our water.
That was Kim Kamensky of Clean Water Portland. Stay tuned to KABU for continuing coverage of the scheme to fluoridate Portland's Bull Run water. And this is Joe Meyer with KABU News.
An Oregon state agency has thrown a wrench in the plans of an Australian energy company trying to export coal through the Columbia River. Ombre Energy was planning to begin construction of a new coal exporting facility at the Port of Morrow near the Boardman Power Plant in the Columbia River Gorge on April 1st. But today's decision means that the energy company will have to delay construction for at least 5 months. The Oregon Department of State Lands says the delay is necessary to ensure that Ombre provides enough research and information to the public on the impact of the coal export facility. This includes environmental impact and the effect it will have on other industries that rely on the preservation of the Columbia River. So far, Ombre Energy has not provided that data as to just how much damage business at the Port of Morrow could cause to the Columbia River's marine life. Port of Morrow plans to receive coal mined from the Powder River Basin in Wyoming and export it via barge to China. The National Wildlife Federation, the Northwest Association of Steelheaders, and the Northwest Guides and Anglers Association are all opposed to the proposed coal export terminal. The start date for construction of Ombre Energy's plant has now been pushed to September 1st of this year.
Lawmakers in the U.S. House and Senate introduced bills today to force approval of the Keystone XL pipeline. With no word yet from President Obama on whether he'll approve the tar sands pipeline, environmental activists are beginning an international week of action tomorrow. In Washington, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
The bills introduced in the House and Senate would waive the Federal Water Pollution Control Act and the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, among other regulations, in order to expedite construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. It would also ban the Environmental Protection Agency from prohibiting or restricting the project.
Keystone is about one simple thing, jobs.
That's North Dakota Republican John Hoeven, the principal sponsor of the bill in the Senate. He and his co-sponsors told reporters Friday that the pipeline would create more than 100,000 jobs for, quote, folks that need it. Yet the State Department's official analysis estimates a much lower number, 42,000 temporary jobs lasting between 1 and 2 years, and only 35 permanent jobs. The Federal Reserve of Atlanta estimates that the country needs to create more than 105,000 permanent jobs every month just to keep the unemployment rate steady. The bill's co-sponsors in the House, including Michigan Republican Fred Upton, also touted the pipeline as a means of reducing oil imports from the Middle East and Venezuela.
This is about North American energy independence. This is a huge factor to allow us to get to that point. Nobody wants to pay $4 a gallon for gas. This is a way that we can bring some stability to the prices and really make sure that we're energy independent.
Upton received more than $210,000 from the oil and gas industry last year alone, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. Researcher and author Lauren Stockman with the Oil Change International also says Upton's claims about the proposed pipeline don't match the U.S. government's own data or trends in global energy markets.
We collected data from U.S. Customs and from the Energy Department that showed that the refineries that will actually receive the oil from Keystone XL on the Texas Gulf Coast in 2012 exported 60% of their gasoline, over 40% of their diesel. You know, most of the products from those refineries are being exported.
Whether or not the majority of the tar sands oil does get exported, it will have little impact on gas prices, which are determined by global trends. Since demand for fossil fuels is increasing overall with the world's population, and the supply of these non-renewable resources will continue to decrease, Stockman says gas prices will keep rising with or without the Keystone pipeline.
That will do nothing to lower oil prices. You know, what relieves the pressure on consumers is using oil more efficiently. When global oil demand starts to decrease, then we might see prices coming down. It's not going to be a result of new supply. It's going to be a result of decreased demand.
The Republican and Democratic sponsors of the pro-Keystone bill expressed confidence that it would pass before Memorial Day. Yet a lawsuit filed by three Nebraska landowners could hold up construction of the pipeline, which they don't want passing through their land. Environmental organizer Jane Klebb, based in Omaha, is working with these landowners and with local indigenous groups who are pursuing legal action for violations of their treaties.
With the reroute of the pipeline in Nebraska, the route now crosses the Ponca Trail of Tears. So the Ponca tribe is looking to submit formal information to the State Department, the Ponca or the Pawnee or the Sioux. All these tribes are saying they have not done a proper consultation. Their rights are not being protected.
When FSRN spoke to members of the Ponca Nation in February, they said they're also considering bringing a case before the United Nations under the Convention on the Rights of Indigenous People. The Nebraska landowner lawsuit goes to trial this June. And starting this weekend, environmental activists in Nebraska and across the country will be kicking off a week of protests targeting corporations that would benefit from the pipeline's construction, including TransCanada, Valero, TD Bank, Sun Life Financial, and a handful of other corporations. In the nation's capital next Thursday, protesters will target the Canadian embassy, which has been heavily lobbying for the pipeline's approval. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6 with Della Ray, local author of The Little Book of Self-Care. At 7, it's the premiere episode of KBOO's own Citizen Sports Report. We'll explore the social dynamics of women who play full contact sports like football or roller derby. Tomorrow's weather is mostly cloudy throughout the day with a slight chance of showers and temperatures in the 50s throughout the weekend.
It's 5:20, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
You might think that your state's political leaders are goofy, but hey, I'm from Texas. Goofy is as goofy does, and Texas does preeminent political goofy. Meet Drew Springer, a first-termer state representative out of the metropolis of Munster, Texas, population 1,600. Proud to be a hardcore GOP right-winger, he spouts the usual dogmatic drivel of that breed. Government has become too large, he prattles, overburdening our lives with excessive regulations that destroy freedoms. So, to strike a bold blow for freedom, Springer has sprung a bill on us called the Shopping Bag Freedom Act. This gem deals with one of the direst threats facing us Texans, the banning of single-use plastic shopping bags by environmentally conscientious cities like Austin. Save our bags, is this goofus's rallying cry. Springer declares that Austin's perfectly sensible decision to keep millions of these pieces of plastic out of our landscape and landfills is an overreach of big government. Yet here he comes, an out-of-town agent of an even bigger government, arrogantly trying to overrule a fully debated and widely popular policy that Austin's democratically elected city officials adopted. Whatever your personal stand is on the politics of single-use plastic bags, surely we can agree that the good citizens of Austin, or of Munster for that matter, ought to have the freedom to decide such a weighty issue for themselves, without the excessive, overburdening intrusion of a state government goofball. The people of Austin decided that they can handle their shopping just fine without incurring the mess of these particular shopping bags, and that should be that. So thanks for your interest, Drew, but buzz off. This is Jim Hightower saying, anyone who thinks Goofy is just a cartoon character never met Springer.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
The CIA's attempts to maintain an unacknowledged program of targeted killing by drones was dealt two separate blows this week. In January of 2010, the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, filed a Freedom of Information Act request for CIA documents on drone strikes. The CIA had previously argued successfully before a district court that even acknowledging the existence of such documents would admit an interest in targeted killings, and that such an admission could endanger national security. But today, Chief Judge Merrick Garland deemed this argument, quote, neither logical nor plausible, because the existence of such a program had already been previously acknowledged by President Obama and CIA Chief John Brennan. The court's decision put an end to what Chief Judge Garland called, quote, fiction of deniability that no reasonable person would regard as plausible. In other drone news, a UN special rapporteur on counterterrorism released a statement today asserting that the Pakistani government has not consented to drone strikes by the U.S. government, and that such strikes are a violation of Pakistan's, quote, sovereignty and territorial integrity. The UN's Ben Emmerson held extensive meetings with the Pakistani officials, local leaders, and victims of drone attacks earlier this week. He found that the Pakistani government believes the targeted killings are counterproductive and, quote, radicalizing a whole new generation.
New documents reveal that Citigroup CEO Michael Corbat received $12 million last year. Corbat only held the position for 3 months after the surprise resignation of Vikram Pandit. Before that, he worked as CEO of Citigroup's Europe, Middle East, and African divisions. Corbat's compensation included over $400,000 housing in London, where he worked from January to October. Citigroup was once the biggest bank in the country and is now third behind J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America. The news came out yesterday when Citigroup submitted annual regulatory documents to the Federal Reserve.
The Mohawk activist John Splitting the Sky Boncore passed away today. He was a long-term supporter of the American Indian Movement and was involved in the Attica prison uprising in the 1970s. During that uprising, he was charged with killing a prison guard and given a life sentence. In 2001, he was released on parole and was later arrested at a protest for attempting to arrest George W. Bush for war crimes. Here's a clip of Splitting the Sky speaking on the Canadian broadcasting system last year.
I grew up in Buffalo, New York. My father was working for a U.S. rubber plant in Buffalo, New York, working two jobs. He and 10 other guys were asked to go inside of these tanks to spray paint them. And they weren't issued safety precautions. And so all 11 men died the next day.
How old were you when that happened?
I was 6 years old. And I had four brothers and sisters, and my mother became a single native Mohawk woman who was a single mother. And in my case, I was put into, I ended up in a boarding school, and I, by myself, and basically was a victim of attempted sexual assaults and numerous racist beatings by the predominantly white staff at the boarding school. The more it happened, the more resistance I put up, and eventually I became a very angry person in terms of the kind of abuse I was receiving at the hands of those that were running these institutions. And then I attempted, out of pure desperation, I had no skills whatsoever, and I attempted a robbery at a mom and pop store, and I was apprehended by two of the proprietors, Italian brothers, and I was taken to jail, and my court-appointed attorney told me that I would probably be released on probation. But when I went to court, the judge basically said, effing savages like you belong behind in a cage. What happened to me is I became a person that became a very rational human being. I spent hours and thousands of hours of study. I studied a number of things on political, social movements, the history of my people as a Mohawk person, indigenous peoples. I found myself becoming a much better, much more productive, positive human being. And so I was able to put a lot of the negative aside and learn to deal with people for who they really are. And I found out that the human race basically as a whole are good people.
That was Native American activist John Splitting the Sky Boncore, who passed away today.
The state of North Dakota today passed the most severe ban on abortions in the country. The bill prevents abortion after 6 weeks into the pregnancy. This is when a heartbeat can be detected through a fetal ultrasound. The ban was passed in the state House of Representatives, but Governor Jack Dalrymple, an abortion opponent, hasn't said whether he'll sign it into law. This ban follows another North Dakota measure banning abortion due to genetic effects such as Down syndrome, as well as gender selection. The only abortion clinic in North Dakota is located in Fargo. Usually abortions cannot be performed before 6 weeks into the pregnancy, so the measure essentially bans abortion altogether. Doctors performing an abortion after this 6 week period will face up to 5 years in prison, felony charges, and can be fined up to $5,000. Proponents of abortion rights said there will be heavy legal costs if the measure is signed into law. They promised to take the case all the way to the Supreme Court if necessary. Republican Representative Betty Grand of Fargo, who introduced the measure, said the possibility of a lawsuit should not stop lawmakers from voting for the ban.
A federal judge has approved a settlement on the controversial Secure Communities program, which immigrant rights advocates are hailing as a landmark decision. Last night's decision will require the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to provide data regarding so-called ICE holds. These holds are used by federal agencies to detain suspects arrested for minor offenses while the government investigates their immigration status. The Secure Communities program has faced widespread criticism from immigrant rights groups, like Portland's VOCE, which is part of the national network that brought the lawsuit against the government. The group's executive director, Romeo Sosa, spoke with KBOO News today about the program's failings.
Supposedly, this program is to arrest dangerous people in the community, but it's not happened. The investigation or what happened is that most of the people who have deported this, it's not like what they mentioned in the beginning. What we have done is to really find out who is being deported under this program. We don't have really exact numbers, but we can see that the deportation, it's not that what's the purpose of the program, which is to deport dangerous people in the community. The people who have been deported, it's people who are jaywalking or driving without license or other minor crimes. The Department of Homeland Security, they say that a year they have to deport 400,000 people, and that's their goal. And they use different programs to get to that goal. ICE hold is when a person, when you get arrested on the street and you end up in jail, when during the bookkeeping, they ask your name and then they know you are there. But because Secure Communities works that it's like an electronic way, it goes to FBI and it goes to ICE. When the name appears there that you are not in the database of ICE. So immediately ICE send a notification that don't let this guy free. So that moment they call ICE holds because ICE already request that you can't be out of jail until they talk to you or they ask you a question, how do you enter in this country? It's supposed to be 48 hours, but some of the sheriff, they have done for weeks or even more. So clearly they participate for, you don't have to hold more than 48 hours, but some of the jails, they do that.
That was Romeo Sosa of the local immigrant rights group, VOCE, speaking about the problems with so-called ICE holds.
In New York, residents of East Flatbush, Brooklyn, continue to protest the shooting death of 16-year-old Kamani Gray by police officers last Saturday night. Police say Gray was armed with a revolver and refused orders from plainclothes officers to stop, but an eyewitness account and a recent autopsy report appear to contradict that account. Police have made multiple arrests and clashed with protesters several times this week. Yesterday, Kamani Gray's mother, Carol Gray, told reporters with Free Speech Radio News that police shootings of youth is a serious issue demanding attention from the community.
I came out today on Kamani Strength, and all the kids that lose their life, the police officers, not only just lose their life, beatings, brutality, wrongfully arrested, you know, just for being a young black kid out there with his pants sagging and past his curfew hours. We all got to join hands and do something about it before someone else gets hurt. Some other young kid gets torn and dragged to the muds and, you know, lose the dignity of who they are as a young black kid and being labeled as gang members and, you know, not what their parents, you know, bring them on earth to be. We make our children, but we don't make their minds.
NYPD Commissioner Raymond Kelly said after the shooting that police interviewed two witnesses who said they heard officers tell Gray not to move. But the city released an autopsy report Wednesday that showed that Gray was hit by seven bullets, three that entered his body from the back. Tashana King told the New York Daily News that she viewed the shooting from her apartment last Saturday, and she was, quote, certain he didn't have anything in his hands, unquote, when police opened fire. King said she was interviewed by police after the shooting. Brooklyn Councilmember Charles Barron said the killing of Gray is just the latest in a series of fatal shootings by the New York police, which has led to deep frustration and anger in the community.
Is a community whose frustration and anger has been pent up after 41 bullets with Amadou Diallo, a stick up our rectum with Abner Louima, 50 bullets for Sean Bell, a bullet in the heart for little Timothy Stansberry, all unarmed and doing nothing wrong, breaking no laws. This is a community who has a lot of pent up frustration, and there's a powder keg going on here. So if we want to talk about peace and stopping the violence, tell the police to stop the police violence. We want justice. Justice stops violence. Justice.
Mayor Michael Bloomberg has promised a full investigation, but residents vow to continue rallying against police violence in their communities.